Payne intended to make good on Webb's foresight. The handful of doubters aside, NASA had no intention of abandoning the moon. And if anyone wondered what would come from going back to the moon, they had only to be inside the windowless lunar receiving laboratory at the manned spacecraft center on the evening of July 25, 1969. In the LRL, five geologists dressed in white hospital-style clothes and caps stood around a vacuum chamber. A big, powerfully built technician reached into a pair of spacesuit arms attached to one side of the chamber to open a silvery container about the size and shape of a large tackle box. Inside, preserved in a lunar vacuum, were pieces of the moon. For the better part of a decade, geologists had labored to extend the disciplines of their science to an alien world by remote observation. What they had managed to learn about the moon from their telescopes, and then the unmanned probes, testified to the power of human intelligence, but they had always longed for the moment when they could probe the moon with their state-of-the-art laboratory instruments, or simply with their own eyes. After long moments of effort, the box was open. The technician removed a mesh covering and a strip of foil that was part of a scientific experiment and set them aside. Then he stepped away from the chamber and let the scientists look. With television carrying the event live, Harvard geologist Clifford Frondell peered into the chamber and blurted, "Holy shit, it looks like a bunch of burnt potatoes." The rocks were so covered with charcoal-colored dust that the geologists couldn't tell anything about them. At this moment, the curiosity that gripped them was not scientific, but human. These were pieces of the moon. Two nights later, the first sample to be cleaned was raised up inside the chamber while Frondell and the other scientists watched. Instantly, they recognized it as a piece of basalt. Familiar minerals glinted under the chamber lights. In the days and months to come, the scientists would try to coax secrets of lunar history from the rocks and dust of the Sea of Tranquility. And this was just the beginning. The moon had been transformed from a light in the sky to a world ripe for exploration, and the geologists had already picked out candidate landing sites for the landings to come, an ambitious and spectacular roster of missions. One team of astronauts would set down at the edge of a huge, winding canyon called Schrutter's Valley, where perhaps a billion years of lunar history might be exposed, layer cake style, in its walls. Another would visit Marius Hills, a field of low, dome-like bumps, which the geologists hoped might be small, ancient volcanoes. The grand finale, for Apollo 20, might be a descent into the yawning amphitheater of Copernicus Crater. These missions would be scientific feasts, with three-day stays on the surface and lunar roving vehicles, or perhaps one-man lunar flyers. Their goal, as ambitious as any in science, was to answer the most basic questions about Earth's nearest neighbor. How did the moon evolve? Was it really the cold, geologically dead world it seemed to be? Where did the moon come from? Solving these mysteries could open doors to even grander ones, for on that pockmarked, lifeless mass might be preserved the earliest history of the solar system long erased on Earth. The scientists' fondest hope was that the moon would tell human beings how their own planet came to be. By November 1969, three astronauts were ready to open the door to these explorations with the flight of Apollo 12. For one of them, the moon represented the end of a long private journey of waiting and perseverance. Friday, November 14, 1969, 11:07 a.m. Eastern Time, Pad 39A, Kennedy Space Center, Florida. With 15 minutes to go, reality grabbed hold of Alan Bean, sealed in his spacesuit, lying on his back inside the command module Yankee Clipper. He felt his heart suddenly pound with anticipation. The spacecraft was on internal power now, and in the right-hand seat, Bean had just put the fuel cells on the line. Now he scanned the gauges for the electrical system. Over in the left-hand couch, Pete Conrad was talking to test conductor Skip Chauvin, nearing the end of the pre-launch checklist. Dick Gordon, in the middle couch, was making last-minute switch settings. It was very quiet. Everything was just the way it had always been in the simulator, but this was no simulation. Silently, Bean told himself they were really going. Already today, the crew of the second lunar landing had faced the threat of postponement because of the weather. Conrad, Gordon, and Bean had arrived at the pad under overcast skies. While they ran through the checklist, a hard November rain lashed at the spacecraft atop its Saturn V booster. Rivulets of water found their way underneath the boost protective cover and danced across the command module windows. But the weather was erratic. The skies would seem to clear for a time and then gloom over again. 3.5 miles away, in the launch control center, launch director Walter Caprian deliberated and occasionally polled Houston for an opinion. Finally, a report from an Air Force weather plane tipped the scales. Ceilings acceptable, winds within limits, no lightning for 19 miles. They would go. It was strange how unreal it had all seemed, up to now. For 8 months, Bean had been training to go to the moon and talking about it, and yet it was hard for him to believe it was really going to happen. Even this morning, as he sat down to a launch day breakfast of steak and eggs with Conrad and Gordon, suited up, then rode out to the pad, it all felt like a practice run. But now, as cryogenic propellants flooded into the Saturn's tanks, Bean knew that the moment of fire and noise was almost upon him, and with it, the end of 6 long years of waiting. He had spent more time as a rookie than any astronaut in his group. Just why, Bean could only guess, and only in retrospect, but none of it mattered now. 5 minutes to go. "Pete, you guys have a good trip," radioed Skip Chauvin. "Yes, sir," said Conrad calmly, confidently. "Sure appreciate everything. Hold off the weather for 5 more, will you?" added Dick Gordon. For Bean, every day of the past 8 months had been an adventure, and the best part of it was training with Conrad and Gordon. The three of them had a bond that went deeper than their mission. They shared a history that began at naval air stations in Florida and California, and the test pilot school at Patuxent River, Maryland. A seat on a lunar mission was as much as any rookie could ask for, but going with Conrad and Gordon was almost too good to be true. "1 minute," Chauvin radioed. Pete Conrad put out his gloved hand, and for a moment the three men clasped hands. Chauvin called, 30 seconds, 12. "Roger," said Conrad. At 14 seconds, Chauvin began to count down. Seconds later, the three men heard the distant rumbling of the Saturn's engines igniting. As Chauvin kept counting down, the spacecraft was engulfed by vibration. There was some noise, but not too much. They could still hear Chauvin's voice counting down to zero, even as the vibrations increased. Somewhere in the midst of that commotion, Apollo 12 left the Earth. "Lift off," called Conrad. "The clock is running." By now the whole spacecraft was shaking, but not as bad, Conrad thought, as he had expected. He scanned the instruments as Dick Gordon called out the time. 3 seconds, 6 seconds. It seemed to take forever for the Saturn to rise past the launch tower, and when it did, Conrad radioed cheerfully to Houston, "That's a lovely liftoff." In the center seat, Dick Gordon glanced through a tiny window in the boost protective cover. "Everything's looking great," he told Conrad. "Sky's getting lighter." Conrad kept a hawk eye on the 8-ball, the artificial horizon indicator that showed the spacecraft's orientation. It registered the Saturn's slow roll as the beast steered onto the proper heading. Everything was right on schedule. It was like a perfect simulation. "Roll's complete," he announced. Suddenly, out of the corner of his eye, Conrad was aware of a bright flash of light outside. At the same instant, a long burst of static filled his ears. He felt the spacecraft tremble. He spoke rapidly over the intercom, his voice flat. "What the hell was that?" Only Conrad had seen the flash, but suddenly all three men heard the sound of the master alarm ringing in their headsets. Conrad glanced over to the center panel and was startled to see almost every light that had anything to do with the electrical system glowing brightly. He could hardly believe his eyes. Simulation upon simulation, and he'd never seen this many warning lights at once. Over the intercom, he started to read them aloud. AC bus, one light, all the fuel cells. I just lost the platform. Conrad saw the eight ball tumble aimlessly. More warning lights came on, confirming that the command module's navigation platform was out of commission. Conrad called Houston. Okay, we just lost the platform, gang. I don't know what happened here. We had everything in the world drop out. Only a slight strain could be heard in his voice. In the right seat, Bean was mystified. He had seen so many electrical crises in the simulator that he could, just by looking at the pattern of warning lights, recognize any given malfunction almost immediately. But he'd never seen so many lights before. The thought flashed through his mind that something had severed the electrical connection between the command module and service module. Had the emergency detection system sensed some problem with the booster, triggering the escape tower and whisking them away? No. He'd have felt a tremendous jolt, and yet something was seriously wrong with the electrical system. Or was it? The meters showed that the spacecraft was still drawing electrical power, although at a lower voltage than normal. Could he even trust the gauges? There's nothing I can tell is wrong, Pete. Conrad keyed his mic and read the list of warning lights to Houston. He hoped Mission Control would be able to tell more than he could. In Mission Control, a young flight director named Jerry Griffin heard Pete Conrad describe, in one breath, the longest list of malfunctions he had ever heard. Griffin couldn't believe this was happening, not on his first mission as a flight director. He was certain he'd have to abort the flight. His voice calm, Griffin called on John Aaron, the bright 24-year-old flight controller in charge of the electrical system, and heard only silence. Griffin called again. What do you see? Aaron's problem was that aside from a bewildering maze of warning lights on his console, there wasn't anything to see. On his screen, telemetry from the spacecraft had been replaced by an undecipherable pattern of numbers, but Aaron had encountered the same problem during a practice run the year before, and he knew how to fix it. He could visualize the command module instrument panel and the switch, labeled signal condition equipment, that the astronauts had to set to recover the data. He said quickly and confidently, "Flight, try SCE to AUX." This control was so obscure that Jerry Griffin had no idea what it was. Neither did Capcom Jerry Carr as he radioed the request to Apollo 12, and neither did Pete Conrad. It was Al Bean who knew where to find the switch, and moments later, Aaron had his telemetry back. For some unknown reason, the spacecraft's fuel cells had been knocked offline. Unless they could be reconnected, the command module would have only its batteries for power, and they were reserved for re-entry. At the flight director's console, Jerry Griffin weighed the possibility of an abort. Still, the Saturn sped onward. Conrad glanced up and saw bright sunlight. They were above the clouds. They were heading in the right direction. Whatever had happened to them, it hadn't touched the booster or its guidance system. They'd make it into orbit, but Conrad was afraid he'd wind up with a dead spacecraft when they got there. The G-meter had passed 3 and was still climbing. Now the intercom buzzed with excited voices, thick with the weight of acceleration.
"Try the buses. Get the buses back on the line. I've lost the event timer. 2 minutes, Ed's auto."
Bean heard Carr say, "Apollo 12, try and reset your fuel cells now." Bean was reluctant to do that without knowing what had gone wrong. Conrad said, "Wait for staging." They were coming up on that chaotic moment when the first stage would drop off and the second stage engines would ignite. Conrad and Gordon told Bean, "Hang on." The first stage fell away, and the three men were slammed against their harnesses, just as they had expected. Seconds later, Bean revived the stunned fuel cells. Everything was back online. Apparently none the worse for wear. As the second stage did its work, Conrad offered a theory. "I'm not sure we didn't get hit by lightning." Conrad was right. As it lifted off, the Saturn had trailed a column of flame and ionized gases which stretched all the way to the ground. Tearing through the rain clouds, it became the world's longest lightning rod. 36 seconds after liftoff, a bolt of electricity discharged right through Apollo 12 and onto the launch tower 6,000 feet below. The command module had shut itself off in response to the tremendous electrical surge. A second strike, at 52 seconds,
unnoticed by Conrad and his crew, had wiped out the navigation platform. Both lightning bolts were recorded by an automatic movie camera near the launch pad, as analysts would later discover. Now, as Bean reconnected the fuel cells, the warning lights blinked out, one by one. The platform was still out, but they would deal with that once they were in orbit. 12, Houston, called Carr. You're right smack dab on the trajectory. The second stage continued its long, smooth push, and inside Yankee Clipper, tension evaporated. Pete Conrad let out a giddy, high-pitched giggle like a schoolboy who had just sneaked out of class without getting caught. Then he laughed, and Gordon and Bean laughed with him. Was that ever a sim they gave us? There were so many lights up there I couldn't read them all. And they laughed all the way into orbit. To Pete Conrad, the launch of Apollo 12 exemplified one of the most important differences between flying airplanes and flying in space. Conrad could remember narrowly avoiding a mid-air collision with another plane when he was at Pax River. After the miss, his heart pounded for several minutes. But during the lightning strike, it was different. There was no terror, nor would there be at any other time in Conrad's four space flights, because things just didn't happen fast enough for that. And it proved one of spaceflight's emerging maxims. If you don't know what to do, don't do anything. Conrad never gave the abort handle a moment's thought. But now, in orbit, Conrad worried that the lightning had damaged something and that Houston was going to call off the mission. They'd ride around the Earth a couple of times and then they'd have to go home. The first order of business was to check out Yankee Clipper's systems. And as soon as Apollo 12 reached orbit, Conrad put his crew to work. Dick Gordon went down in the lower equipment bay, sweating through an effort to realign Yankee Clipper's navigation platform with the stars. He kept talking to Bean, saying, "I don't see anything, Al," and for a while he wondered, what happened to the stars? Finally, he realized he hadn't given his eyes a chance to adapt to darkness. Bean, consulting the star chart, told him he ought to be seeing the constellation Orion. And sure enough, there it was in the telescope, with brilliant Sirius nearby. Gordon made the alignment, with little time to spare. During breaks in the work, Conrad and Gordon gave Bean a guided tour of Earth orbit. "Here comes sunrise, Al," they said, or, "Hey, there's an island down there." And then in darkness over Africa, "Look down there, those are campfires." And he looked up from his checklist to witness the most amazing sights of his life. But for Bean, as well as his veteran crewmates, the lightning strike had been just as memorable. "That'll give them something to write about tonight," said Conrad, thinking of the press. "I'll bet your wife, my wife, and Al's wife fainted dead away." Gordon said, "I bet they did when you started calling out about 18 lights." "Every time I close my eyes," Conrad said, "all I see are those lights." For Conrad, Gordon, and Bean, the launch of Apollo 12 had already become a sea story that they would tell again and again for the rest of their lives. To their relief, everything on the command module and the lander, which was undergoing scrutiny in Houston via telemetry, seemed to be checking out perfectly. At 2 hours, 28 minutes, Jerry Carr radioed the message they'd been waiting for. "Apollo 12, the good word is your go for TLI. "Whoop-dee-doo," crowed Conrad. "We're ready. We didn't expect anything else." What Mission Control did not tell Conrad was that they feared the lightning had damaged the pyrotechnic system used to deploy the command module's parachutes. Chris Kraft in Houston had conferred with other NASA managers at the Cape, and they decided to continue the mission. The rationale was simple. Conrad and his crew would be just as dead if the parachutes didn't work now as they would after coming back from the moon, 10 days from now. Minutes later, Conrad, Gordon, and Bean were strapped in, waiting for the third stage to relight. When it did, all three men felt it rumbling away, speeding them out of Earth orbit. Conrad said, "Al Bean, you're on your way to the moon." "Yeah," Bean replied. "Y'all can come along if you like." There was a picture on the wall of Dick Gordon's study in Nassau Bay, a signed photograph of a young, flight-suited Pete Conrad, with a bit more hair, posing next to a Phantom jet. Conrad was about to leave Miramar Naval Air Station in San Diego to report to his new job as an astronaut. By the time that photograph was taken, Conrad and Gordon had become best friends. They had shared the snap of the catapult on the deck of the carrier Ranger, where they had roomed together and flown missions with their squadron. Their friendship was cemented in weeks at sea and in the night spots of San Diego. And in the summer of 1962, they had shared the hope of making it into the second astronaut selection. Gordon didn't find out that Pete had succeeded until the public announcement in the middle of September. Soon after, Gordon got a letter from Robert Gilruth, the director of the Manned Spacecraft Center, saying that he was sorry, but although his qualifications had been excellent, Gordon's feelings could not have been more divided. Joyful that Pete had made it, heartbroken that he wasn't going with him. Maybe Pete was just being his optimistic self, or maybe he had a premonition of how things would someday turn out, but when he gave Gordon that portrait, he wrote on it, "To Dick, until we serve together again." It was no exaggeration to say that the high point of Dick Gordon's life were the 3 days he and Pete Conrad spent in orbit on Gemini 11. Even before launch, they had earned a reputation as the cockiest, not to mention the most fun-loving, team of astronauts ever to fly. Conrad, short, balding, and wisecracking, and Gordon, not much taller, but more formidable, with the rugged face and build of a boxer. Gordon's friends knew him as a man of strong emotions. He was such a ladies' man that Conrad, much to Gordon's dislike, took to calling him Animal. Unlike many astronauts, Dick Gordon had not had boyhood dreams of being a pilot. Growing up in Seattle, his family hard hit by the Great Depression, he had dreamed of the priesthood. In college, he majored in chemistry but considered pursuing a professional baseball career. Finally, he settled on dentistry. But soon after graduation, his life was interrupted by the Korean War, and it was only then, in the Navy, that Gordon found his calling. Gravitating toward the excitement of aviation, he was hooked after his first training flight. After the war, flying with a squadron that had the reputation of being the cockiest in the Navy, Gordon won top honors for his precision in the maneuvers used to deliver nuclear weapons. Then it was on to the test pilot school at Pax River, where his friendship with Pete Conrad began. Gemini 11 solidified the bond between the two men, on duty and off. They thought alike, they flew alike. In the simulator, or in a T-38, they anticipated each other's moves as if they were communicating by telepathy. Everything about them said, "I'm the best. See if you can get one up on me." By the time Conrad and Gordon lifted off in November 1966, they already had enough stories to last a long time, and there were more waiting for them in Earth orbit. An hour and a half after launch, Conrad and Gordon shared the triumph of the first one-orbit rendezvous and docked with an Agena target rocket. A day later, Gordon climbed outside Gemini 11, trailing a 30-foot umbilical, and faced the most dangerous experience of his life. His assignment was to attach a Dacron tether from the Agena to the nose of the Gemini in preparation for a later experiment. But his body kept floating off the Gemini, and with no means of anchoring himself, he worked so hard that he overloaded the cooling system in his suit. By the time he had attached the tether, his heart rate had reached 180 beats per minute. His breathing was heavy, his eyes stung with perspiration. Inside Gemini 11, Conrad was gripped with concern for his partner. He knew that if Gordon became incapacitated, there would be no way to pull the man, in his pressurized suit, back into the tiny cabin. Conrad would have no choice but to cut him loose and go back without him. Unwilling to order his co-pilot back inside, he waited, hoping Gordon would make that decision on his own. Conrad would remember those moments as the scariest he had ever experienced in a space flight, and that included the lightning strike on Apollo 12. But the flight also had its funny moments. On the third day, Gordon took a second, much more leisurely spacewalk. This time, he merely stood up in the hatch and shot astronomical photographs. During a lull, as Gemini 11 drifted in daylight over the Atlantic, Conrad fell asleep, his arms sticking out in front of him in his pressurized spacesuit. He awoke with a start and said to Gordon, "Hey, Dick, would you believe I fell asleep?" To which Gordon answered, "Huh? What?" He'd been asleep, too, standing in the void, whizzing around the world at 17,000 miles an hour. When Pete Conrad moved on to Apollo, there was no question that Gordon would come with him. Under other circumstances, the two men might have landed on the moon together, but Deke Slayton had a rule that command module pilots, like commanders, had to be veterans of space rendezvous. But the lunar module pilot seat could be filled by a rookie, and Pete Conrad knew just who that rookie should be. From the very beginning, Alan Bean saw the world differently from other test pilots. Long before he ever flew, as a boy in Fort Worth, Texas, he was captivated by the beauty of the airplane in motion. In the summer of 1956, the 24-year-old Bean, thin and bright-eyed, with the well-toned body of a college gymnast, arrived at Jacksonville Naval Air Station. He was the youngest and newest member of Attack Squadron VA-44. In a group photo taken sometime afterward, two things about Bean stand out: his ear-to-ear grin and his tie, which is almost the only one that's perfectly straight. Even as a squadron pilot, Bean's sense of aesthetics was very much intact. He longed to fly the best-looking planes, like the sleek F-8U fighter. Unlike the other pilots who spent their free time fixing up old cars, Bean took night classes in oil painting. Bean had always been a loner, but he felt close to the flyers in VA-44. It was a place where everyone had a nickname. There was Dancing Bear and Rocky Pie, Spanky, Dinky, Tiger Jack, and Von Du Quick. Sometimes they called Bean Sarsaparilla because he never touched a drink. Sometimes they just called him Beano. Once, on Liberty in Paris, the pilots went drinking and decided to put sarsaparilla to good use. While they drank inside, Bean did gymnastics outside. Before long, he drew a crowd. His squadron mates then came out, one by one, to look for a date. When it came to flying, Bean wasn't a natural, like some of his squadron mates who seemed born to be great aviators. But whatever Bean lacked in innate talent, he made up in effort. Through sheer determination, he mastered the subtleties of precision bombing from a speeding jet and turned himself into one of the best weapons delivery pilots in the squadron. After a 2-year tour at Pax River, Bean felt he'd reached the pinnacle of his profession. And while he shared the other flyers' drive to be the best, he was always aware that his outlook differed from theirs, even after he left Pax River for another attack squadron in Cecil Field, Florida. In 1962, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was talk of sending Bean and his colleagues into combat. The other pilots wanted it so bad they could taste it. After all, this was what they had been trained for. Bean would have gone in a minute to defend the interests of his country, but he was hardly excited about it. There was no love of combat in his soul, only a love of flying. By that time, Bean had his sights on a new goal, to become an astronaut. At the suggestion of one of his former instructors from Pax River, he applied for the second selection in 1962. He made it into the final group of 35 pilots, but no further. The instructor, whose name was Pete Conrad, went all the way. The following year, Bean applied again. This time he made it. At NASA, Bean was surprised at how different it felt to be in the astronaut office than it had in the squadron or at Pax River. Camaraderie was overshadowed by competition for flights. And for some of the rookies, Al Shepard was an ominous presence. To Bean, Shepard seemed like a tiger shark swimming around in a tank full of fish. He didn't go after the big fish. He liked to take a bite out of a minnow every now and then. For quite a while, Bean felt like a minnow. And once again, Bean felt he saw things differently from the other pilots. The old head's animosity for the doctors, for example, made no sense to him. So what if they didn't like Chuck Berry? Did that mean they shouldn't cooperate with him? Another day it might be some PR requirement. The television people would want to film astronauts in training, and the old heads would grumble. Bean thought, what's the problem? We won't even know they're there. And he didn't hesitate to say so in front of Shepard and Slayton. Nor did Bean share the old head's view of the non-test pilots in the office. He gravitated to Anders, Cunningham, and Schweikert precisely because they were different. They thought about things other than flying and work. They examined their lives. Rusty Schweikert taught him to understand points of view very different than the ones he had learned in the military. He marveled at Bill Anders's intellect, not only about science but about the ways of the world, and he admired outspoken Walt Cunningham for his directness. For Bean, being with the three of them was an education. But Bean wasn't learning the right lessons about being an astronaut. He followed Bill Anders's motto, work hard and someone will notice, and when he was named as backup commander on one of the last Gemini missions, He thought his day had finally come. Never mind that Gemini would be over before he had a chance to fly. He was sure Slayton and Shepard had recognized what he could do and that they were grooming him for Apollo. But in the fall of 1966, he got his assignment, astronaut representative on the Apollo Applications Project, the space station planned for Earth orbit in the 1970s. Bean's heart sank as he saw his chances for a lunar mission evaporate. While he was flying a desk, Anders, Cunningham, and Schweikert were getting ready to fly in space, and maybe even to walk on the moon. In the fall of 1966, when Deke Slayton asked Pete Conrad to pick a lunar module pilot, he requested his old student from Pax River, Alan Bean. Slayton told Conrad that Bean was unavailable. He was assigned to Apollo Applications. Why Bean was put on AAP, Conrad had no idea, but in his own mind it was a bad deal. He couldn't help wonder whether somebody had put Bean there to get him out of the way. It wouldn't have been the first time Bean had gotten in trouble, and Conrad had been around for that, too. In 1960, Bean arrived at Pax River and became one of Conrad's students. Conrad had met the younger man 4 years earlier in Jacksonville, where they flew in sister squadrons. At Pax, Bean was quieter and more serious than many of the other pilots Conrad taught. He wasn't the best aviator in his class, but he was near the top and definitely one of the brighter students. The thing Conrad noticed most about Bean was his persistence. Once he latched onto a problem, he was absolutely tenacious about finding a solution, and he wouldn't let go until somebody listened. Bean also tended to speak his mind, a little too much for his superiors. When it came time to give the graduates their assignments, Conrad found out that the brass were planning to send Bean to electronics test, the boondocks of test flight. Conrad went to the school commander and argued Bean's case for better duty, and his intervention won Bean a place in service test, where pilots wrung out new airplanes before clearing them for squadron duty. For a pilot of Bean's caliber, it was a far better place to be. But in 1966, there was nothing Conrad could do to rescue his former student. Slayton wasn't letting him have Bean, and that was that. So Conrad chose another astronaut he knew, a big, friendly bear of a Marine named C.C. Williams, who had also been one of his students at Pax. Williams stood just over 6 feet tall. During the third astronaut selection, he made it under the height limit, just barely, by spending the night before the physical jumping up and down to compress his spine. Williams brought a gentle, self-effacing presence to the astronaut corps. He would set his jaw and utter with mock seriousness, "I'm a Marine. I'm a trained killer." As the first bachelor in the astronaut office, he was the envy of his colleagues. This distinction ended when he married a former water-skiing performer from Florida's Cypress Gardens. Williams fit in well with Conrad and Gordon, and the three of them leaped into training as the backup crew for the first manned lunar module flight. Meanwhile, Alan Bean toiled in the backwaters of Apollo Applications, oblivious to Conrad's efforts. In the Navy, he had learned to meet adversity with a positive attitude. His commander in service test at Pax River would always remember Bean for taking an unpleasant job and doing it better than any junior officer he'd ever seen. And it turned out that when NASA put out a call for new astronauts, the man was on the Navy Astronaut Selection Committee. He made sure Bean was on the list. Bean made up his mind that he would do the best job on AAP that anyone had ever seen. But as time passed, Bean began to see that doing a great job wasn't enough if the right people didn't know about it. Slayton and Shepard wouldn't notice him unless he learned to promote himself, and he'd have to make it look unintentional. That would take some work. Some of the 14 were masters at it. Bean would study their technique, and he would learn when to keep his mouth shut. Playing politics was abhorrent to him, but he had no choice. But these realizations had come a few years too late. No one knows how long he would have stayed there in what Pete Conrad called Tomorrow Land if fate had not intervened. On October 5th, 1967, C.C. Williams was flying a T-38 from the Cape to Mobile, Alabama, to see his father, who was dying of cancer. Near Tallahassee, the airplane suddenly went into an uncontrollable aileron roll. The jet lost all its lift and became a ballistic projectile, accelerating earthward at a horrendous rate. Williams followed the procedures for emergency ejection, but the T-38 was going so fast that he was already far too low for his parachute to save him. Not long afterward, Bean was at Ellington and ran into Pete Conrad on the flight line. Since coming to NASA, Bean hadn't really had much contact with Conrad. They were in different astronaut groups, and aside from the pilots' meetings, there had been only occasional brief encounters. Now his old teacher said, "Have you got a minute, Al?" Conrad had told Slayton he wanted Bean as his new lunar module pilot. Slayton had agreed. Bean couldn't believe what he was hearing. Deliverance had come. They called him Beano, and he fit right in. His quiet seriousness complemented Conrad and Gordon's bravado. He didn't race cars, as they did. When it came to training, Conrad and Gordon had a certain restlessness about them. "Let's get on with it," that was their style. But Bean delved into the writing of checklists as if it were his only profession. He sweated the details Conrad and Gordon hated. Even his eating habits were single-minded. He ate spaghetti almost every night of the week. They gave him all the razzing due him as the rookie on the crew, but they respected him, and each other. They soon became a fixture at the Cape, where they were backing up Jim McDivitt's crew for the first LM mission. Now that he was on a crew, Bean realized that his whole outlook had changed. The every-man-for-himself undercurrent of the astronaut office no longer applied to the three of them. They were in this together, and they were going to fly the best mission ever flown. Together, they had more camaraderie than just about any Apollo crew. That didn't mean the competition was over. To the contrary, it gave the men a chance to fuel the friendly inter-service rivalry that permeated the astronaut corps. They were the first all-Navy Apollo crew, and Conrad was always glad for a chance to get some mileage out of it. McDivitt's crew was all Air Force, and Conrad would say things like, "Well, Jim, the Navy's always glad to help out the Air Force." Then there was that fateful day in 1968 when, in the plan to send Apollo 8 to the moon, McDivitt's crew swapped places in line with Frank Borman's. Bean still remembered how Pete and Dick reacted. "It was a bad deal," they said. Until then, it looked as if they might have a shot at the first lunar landing, but this was going to screw all that up. And Bean was just so happy to be on a flight, any flight, that it never occurred to him to think about being first or second to land on the moon. By the fall of 1969, now training for the second lunar landing, Conrad, Gordon, and Bean had been at the Cape so long they seemed like permanent residents. Conrad had gotten to know a Cocoa Beach car dealer named Jim Rathman, a former Indianapolis 500 winner who made fast friends with the astronauts from the original seven on down. Thanks to Rathman, General Motors gave the astronauts great deals on sports cars, and sometime during the training for Apollo 9, Conrad had worked a deal for three matching gold Corvettes and had Rathman's shop customize them with futuristic black trim and a small CDR for Mission Commander Conrad, CMP for Command Module Pilot Gordon, and LMP for Lunar Module Pilot Bean. The security guards got used to seeing the three Corvettes tool out of the gate of Patrick Air Force Base in the early evening and head down Route A1A for Cocoa Beach. They were like a bunch of squadron buddies. They shared each other's lives as well as work. In the morning, before a simulator run, the conversations sounded like the ready room at the squadron. "Let me tell you what happened last night." You wouldn't find the backup crew, Dave Scott, Al Worden, and Jim Irwin, telling jokes about adventures from the night before when they came in for work. And it was that way because Conrad set the tone. Conrad was the glue. In the simulator, Conrad was spectacular. The instructors would throw everything in the book at him, and there wasn't anyone who could solve problems faster or react quicker. If Conrad had one weakness, it was his language. When decorum was required, Conrad carried himself with all the poise of a Princeton-educated Navy officer. But most of the time he raised colorful to an art form. In the simulator, he whistled and hummed and cracked his chewing gum so loudly that the instructors winced under their headsets. And when the malfunctions got thick, he swore like a sailor. The instructors smiled and shook their heads. "What's this guy going to do during the flight?" And in the next minute, they'd break up laughing because they'd hear Bean's quiet voice in the background. "Yep, that's astronaut talk. A-okay, I gotta learn that." The instructors' worries were nothing compared to those of the NASA public affairs people. When it looked as if Conrad might have the first landing in his pocket, they chuckled at the thought of this little wisecracking balding guy with a gap-toothed grin as the first man on the moon. Now, faced with the prospect of Pete Conrad on the airwaves, They were decidedly uneasy. They had barely recovered from the criticism that followed Jean Cernan's profanity during Apollo 10. Never mind that Cernan had been in a life-or-death crisis a quarter of a million miles from Earth, the letters came anyway, and they weren't the only ones who were worried. One day during training, Bean said to his commander, "You know, you can't talk like that on the flight." And Conrad replied that it was people like himself who swore a lot on the ground who never slip up over the air during a flight. "Furthermore," he told Bean, "people like you, who hardly ever swear, are the ones who do." That was the end of it. But Conrad had to laugh at the thought that Bean would worry about that until the end of the mission. Pete Conrad had been disappointed not to fly the first lunar landing, and there were plenty of NASA people, at the Cape and in Houston, who were surprised when he didn't get it. He was in mission control when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon, and he was there when everyone, from the NASA managers in the control center to the geologists in a back room to Mike Collins in lunar orbit, were trying to figure out where Armstrong and Aldrin had landed. Sam Phillips turned to Bill Tindall and said, "Next time, I want a pinpoint landing." Phillips's request was understandable. There was no point in having the geologists painstakingly choose a landing site when there was no certainty of being able to get there. But Tindall thought it was impossible. After all, Eagle had landed 4 miles away from its aim point. The trajectory people had identified several sources for the error and had figured out how to prevent them from recurring, but one unknown persisted, namely the moon's lumpy gravity field. Even now, no one knew exactly what mascons would do to the lunar module's path, so predicting its precise trajectory ahead of time was impossible. But when Tindall convened the trajectory experts, a young mathematician named Emil Schieser made a breakthrough. The key was the Doppler effect. The apparent shift in frequency of light waves, or sound waves, emitted from a moving object as detected by a stationary observer. You can experience the Doppler effect standing next to a highway. The horn of a passing car seems to rise in pitch as it speeds toward you, then fall as it moves away. The same phenomenon changes the apparent frequency of radio waves received from a spacecraft moving toward or away from the tracking stations on Earth. Tiny Doppler shifts were already being used by controllers to analyze the trajectories of Apollo spacecraft during their lunar voyages. Radio signals from an LM in lunar orbit, Schieser pointed out, have a predictable pattern of Doppler shift. The effect is strongest when the lander is flying over the edge of the moon, as seen from Earth, and weakest when it is over the geographic center of the near side. If planners could predict the pattern of Doppler shifts, they could compare that information with the actual shifts they detected. The differences would in turn reveal whether the lunar module was off course, and by how much. Schieser's idea was brilliantly elegant, but it left the problem of how to give that information to the astronauts in a form that would be easy to feed into the LM's guidance computer. Soon that answer, too, emerged in Tindall's meetings. The solution was to fool the computer into thinking the landing point itself had moved rather than the lander. That change required entering only a single number. At the same time, mission planners deliberated on where to send Apollo 12. They could simply have picked out a specific crater, but planning coordinator Jack Sevier had a better idea. The unmanned Surveyor 3 probe was perched on the vast lava plain called the Ocean of Storms, where it had landed in April 1967. The geologists had already identified the Ocean of Storms as one of their candidate targets for the second landing. They suspected its rocks would be younger than, and perhaps chemically different from, those in the Sea of Tranquility. Now Surveyor 3 became the target for the first pinpoint lunar landing. It was a bold decision to commit the system to such a visible measure of success or failure. If Conrad and Bean missed, everyone would know it. But that was exactly the point. This goal would drive NASA to achieve what had first seemed impossible. Conrad and Bean were to spend 31.5 hours on the moon, some 10 hours longer than Armstrong and Aldrin. During that time, they would take 2 moonwalks, each lasting about 3.5 hours. most of the first excursion would be devoted to setting out an autonomous scientific station called the Apollo Lunar Surface Experiment Package, or ALSEP. The second walk would be an extended geologic traverse, culminating with a visit to Surveyor 3. Conrad and Bean would cut off pieces of the probe so the engineers could see what had happened to it during its 31 months on the lunar surface. Conrad was thrilled with his mission. If he couldn't make the first landing, this was the next best thing. He and Bean weren't simply going to get down in one piece, grab a few rocks, and take off. They had the first lunar surface operations plan, a timeline packed with good, useful work for the scientists. And if they really did manage to land next to the Surveyor, they would open the way for the pinpoint landings the geologists wanted. As the months of training wore on, the simulator instructors at the Cape considered Conrad, Gordon, and Bean one of the sharpest, most competent teams that had ever trained for space. Conrad joked that they should solve NASA's crew selection worries by volunteering to fly every mission from then on, rotating seats on each flight. Next time it would be Gordon, Bean, Conrad, then Bean, Conrad, Gordon. By the day before launch, Conrad felt ready. The mission he had worked toward for 7 long years was finally upon him. That night, he and Gordon and Bean were joined for dinner in the crew quarters by Tom Paine. Later, in the parking lot, Paine made a promise to Conrad. If some problem came up and he didn't get to land, Paine said, he would put Conrad and his crew on the very next mission, so they shouldn't do anything rash. Conrad thanked Paine for his kind offer and said goodbye. He was halfway up the stairs when he realized Paine had made the same promise to Neil Armstrong. 2. Shore leave. Monday, November 17th, 11:45 p.m., Houston time, 3 days, 13 hours, 23 minutes, mission elapsed time. 24 hours from now, Bino, we're on our way down, pal. That's when I get nervous. Find that little mother, and I'll land it right side up. Pete Conrad was anxious, and he wasn't trying to hide it. But right now, as he and his crew settled in for their first day in lunar orbit, the atmosphere inside Yankee Clipper belied his tension. In the background, Frank Sinatra crooned "The Girl from Ipanema" on the tape recorder. The conversation was decidedly relaxed, unlike the sparse exchanges of Armstrong and his crew. It was the banter of three friends on vacation together in the wilderness. "If they made up a Hollywood movie just like this, you wouldn't believe it," said Bean. "What do you mean?" asked Conrad. "Listening to this music on the backside of the moon," Gordon countered. "You got something against music?" "Nobody would buy it," Bean said. "This is cornball. You got to be hard out there." "Say, the biggest thing I missed on Gemini 5 was not having any music," said Conrad. What he would have given for that tape player then, cooped up in that tiny cabin for 8 days. For Apollo 12, he'd brought along some of his favorite tunes, mostly country and western stuff, like Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys version of San Antonio Rose, that sent Gordon and Bean into hiding. Bean's tape was top 40, which they all liked well enough, especially the bubblegum hit called Sugar Sugar. When it came on during the trip out from Earth, the three of them would hold on to the struts in the command module and bounce weightlessly to the beat, dancing their way to the moon. Conrad would say it emphatically in the debriefing, "People have got to have some entertainment on these flights. You can't just look out the window." Conrad was happy with the way things were going. Since the lightning strike, they hadn't had a single problem worth mentioning. That was the best way to start a flight, get all the trouble out of the way early. And next to Gemini, the command module was like a hotel. There was warm water for rehydrating the food and the coffee. There was toothpaste and shaving. By now, Conrad was looking forward to getting cleaned up. "Hey, I'm going to take a bath tonight," he announced. "Take a bath, shave, get all cleaned up, good night's sleep." He turned to Bean. "You got anything else to do tomorrow?" "All right, that's what we'll do then. We'll go for a little lunar landing. How's that? Unless you got something better in mind, a little surfing at the beach or something." "Hell yes," Bean said. Gordon joined in. "How about the backside sand? Go play in the sand on the backside." "Yeah," Conrad laughed. "Let's take the LM down and land on the backside. Wouldn't that shake 'em up?" But behind the banter, Conrad was ever mindful of what was coming up. No doubt about it, the stakes had changed with this mission. Just getting the LM down in one piece wasn't good enough. The real test was finding Surveyor 3. According to the scientists, the Surveyor was sitting on the slopes of a worn old crater 656 feet across. Immediately around it were several other craters, a bit smaller and sharper. It was this clump of craters that Pete Conrad would have to locate among thousands of others when his lunar module pitched over for its descent to the moon. Seen from the east, the view Conrad would have during his approach, the craters looked like the outline of a snowman, with the Surveyor sitting in the pit of its fat belly. He simply named it the Surveyor Crater. He named the other craters appropriately: head, left foot, right foot. On the photographs, there appeared to be a fairly smooth area on the near right side of the Surveyor Crater, and that was where Conrad would try to land. If that place, which became known as Pete's parking lot, turned out to be unsuitable, or if Conrad couldn't get to it, he must try to land close enough to the probe for him and Bean to reach it on foot without difficulty. Before the flight, Chris Kraft had told Conrad not to stress the Surveyor when he talked to the press. Otherwise, if he landed off target, the press would say the mission had failed, even if he and Bean accomplished all the other objectives. But to Conrad, the bottom line was that if he and Bean didn't find Surveyor 3, all their planning would be for naught. The geologic traverse was designed around the various craters of the snowman, and the future exploration of the moon depended on the pinpoint landing capability. It was up to Mission Control to put his lunar module on target, and it was up to Conrad to land. Tuesday, November 18th, 4 o'clock p.m. Houston time, 4 days, 5 hours, 38 minutes mission elapsed time. I'm about as jumpy as I can be this morning. For Alan Bean, the anticipation was over. Now it was time for him to do the thing he had been training to do all these months. Stick to the checklist. Be steady. Don't throw the wrong switch. Bean couldn't deny it. This was the big day. "Oh, you noticed?" Conrad said wryly, as the two men ate breakfast over the lunar far side. Neil Armstrong had never said a word about anxiety, but Conrad wasn't Armstrong. "I just hope we find the old snowman. Then I hope we find a place to land. Then I hope I can set it down all right." Between bites of Canadian bacon, Conrad confessed, "It's driving me buggy. I just don't know what I'm going to see when I pitch over. You know," Conrad laughed at the thought of his own helplessness, "I'm either going to say, 'Ah, there it is,' or I'm going to say, 'Freeze it. I don't recognize nothing.'" "If you don't recognize a thing," Bean offered, "just tell me. I'll look out my side, and you look at the computer for a few seconds and let me see if I see anything out there." Below them, the sun cast long shadows over a battlefield of craters. The near side of the moon didn't impress Pete Conrad, but the far side, with its enormous bumps and hollows, that did amaze him. He looked down at what seemed to be a string of small volcanoes. "That's fantastic," he exclaimed to Bean. Then he thought for a moment about where they were, and he said quietly, "How'd we ever get here, anyway?" And he and Bean laughed. It had always amazed Alan Bean that in all the time they had spent training together, Dick Gordon had never once showed the disappointment he had to feel every time he heard Bean introduced as the guy who was going to the moon with Pete Conrad. There was never a trace of sarcasm from Gordon, never an ironic remark. He had done everything to make Bean feel welcome on the crew. Bean knew that if the situation had been reversed, he could not have handled it as well. Now, Gordon was suspended at the end of the docking tunnel between Yankee Clipper and Intrepid, looking down at Conrad and Bean. It was a moment for goodbyes, and yet none were said. "I guess I've got to close the hatch now," Gordon said, and he looked at his two friends for a moment, and then sealed the tunnel. Bean wondered whether he would ever see Gordon again. Minutes later, Gordon flipped the switch to release them, and for a few minutes, Yankee Clipper and Intrepid flew in formation while Gordon took pictures. Then, as Conrad and Bean watched, Gordon pulled away. Gordon kept the spindly four-legged craft in sight through the 28-power sextant. When Conrad and Bean fired their descent engine to drop out of lunar orbit, Gordon was looking straight up Intrepid's engine bell. The spacecraft carrying his friends seemed to become a glowing ball, like the view into a jet engine climbing on afterburner. The glow lasted just under half a minute, then died. Wednesday, November 19th, 12:42 a.m. Houston time. 4 days, 14 hours, 20 minutes mission elapsed time. If the lunar module belonged to any astronaut, it was Pete Conrad's. He knew everything about the LM cabin because he'd helped to design it. Back in 1963, he'd been in on some of the major changes, taking out the seats and letting the pilots fly standing up, replacing the round forward hatch with a bigger, square one that could accommodate an astronaut wearing a bulky backpack, adding a small rendezvous window above the commander's head. That had been a battle. They'd tried to tell him, the pilot, that he didn't need one, and the list went on. As Intrepid's descent engine ignited 50,000 feet above the moon, Conrad suddenly flashed back to 5 years earlier when he was visiting the Grumman plant on Long Island and standing in a mock-up of the LM, then known as the Bug. The instrument panels were nothing but drawings pasted onto plywood, but Conrad had stood there and imagined himself descending to the surface of the moon. Now it was happening. Intrepid's engine came silently to life, right on schedule. Bean welcomed the acceleration. After 5 days of weightlessness, it felt good to be standing again. Conrad scanned the gauges, and Intrepid continued its long ride down. Ever since the pinpoint landing became his mission last summer, Conrad had wondered whether craftspeople really could pull it off. But they were confident. So confident, in fact, that Conrad sometimes had trouble taking them seriously. One day Conrad was talking to trajectory specialist Dave Reed about his landing point. Reed asked, "Where do you want me to put you?" Conrad doubted it would make much difference what he told Reed. After all, Armstrong and Aldrin had landed 4 miles off target. But Reed was talking like a travel agent making an airline reservation. Conrad went along and picked a spot, with due consideration to sun angle, traverse distance, and the like. Then, after a few simulated landings, he changed his mind and went back to Reed for a new spot a few hundred feet to one side. Without batting an eye, Reed set about figuring out the necessary changes to the software, and Conrad couldn't believe the man was serious. He blurted, "You can't hit it anyhow. Target me for the center of the surveyor crater." Reed answered, "You got it, babe." But Conrad would believe it when he saw it. 12:51 a.m. At 8,000 feet, with pitch over almost upon them, Conrad leaned forward in his spacesuit, straining to glimpse the snowman. He told Bean, "I think I see my crater. I'm not sure." Then, right on schedule at 7,000 feet, Intrepid pitched forward for the final descent. Suddenly, Conrad beheld a ghostly black-and-white panorama, seemingly too stark to be real. 10,000 shadows inside 10,000 craters. Conrad felt a stab of unease. He couldn't find a single feature he recognized. But when he sighted along the 40-degree mark on his window, suddenly, "Hey, there it is! There it is! Son of a gun, right down the middle of the road!" Far in the distance, Conrad could see the snowman. Tiny, almost lost in the sea of craters, Intrepid was headed for the very center of the surveyor crater. Even as Bean tried to read him LPD angles, Conrad was too excited to listen. "Look out there! I can't believe it! Fantastic!" But the targeting was almost too good. Conrad wasn't about to land in the middle of the surveyor crater. As the computer flew Intrepid down, Conrad told it to shift the aim point short and to the right of the crater. He would give Pete's parking lot a try after all. He heard Jerry Carr's voice. "Intrepid, Houston, go for landing." 1,000 feet above the moon, Bean stole a glance out his window and saw a bright field of craters, with the surveyor crater as big as life, directly ahead. They were coming in at great speed. Up to now, the landing had seemed like a simulation, but this was almost more than he could stand to look at. It was amazing, even frightening. Quickly, he turned his gaze back to the instruments. His voice was calm as he told Conrad, "Looks good out there, babe. Looks good." But Pete's parking lot didn't look very good to Conrad. It looked more like Pete's battlefield. Again he shifted the landing point, this time further downrange. "You're at 530 feet, Pete," called Bean. "You're all right." But they were still coming in like a bullet. Conrad wanted time to slow down and look for a landing spot. And he could afford to. They were fat on fuel. As Intrepid descended through 400 feet, Conrad took over. He pitched the craft back to kill their forward speed. Intrepid slowed, but not as soon as Conrad wanted. He saw the surveyor crater drift past and said, "Gosh, I flew by it." Conrad looked out to his left, just beyond the crater's northwest rim, and saw where he wanted to land, a smooth area between surveyor crater and head crater. He banked Intrepid hard to the left. The craft responded with the same sluggishness as the LLTV at Ellington. Bean, who had never flown the landing trainer, was surprised to see the eight ball in front of him tilt so sharply. He wondered what Conrad was doing. He said in a calm Texas drawl, "Hey, you're really maneuvering around." "Yep," Conrad answered, too busy to say anything more. "Come on down, Pete," Bean coached, his eye on the rate of descent gauge. Bean knew that Conrad must not descend too slowly while they were this high up. It would cost too much fuel. 200 feet, coming down at 3, Bean said. "Need to come on down." "Okay," Conrad answered. In the simulator, he had always waited until they were down to 100 feet or so, before arresting the last bit of forward speed and starting the final vertical descent. But some instinct now prompted him to level off early. It was the best decision he made, because within moments, his view of the surface began to blur. Intrepid was kicking up a tremendous amount of dust, far more than Armstrong and Aldrin's movies had suggested. The dust shot away from him in bright streaks, rushing to the horizon. 96 feet, coming down at 6. "Slow down the descent rate," Bean called quickly, urgently. The dust blanket thickened. Conrad could see nothing but streaks, with a few rocks sticking up here and there. He had no idea whether there were any craters directly underneath him, but he would have to take his chances. "Looking real good," said Bean, his eyes glued to the gauges. 50 feet coming down. Watch for the dust." Bean didn't see the dust storm already raging outside his window. Still, Intrepid crept downward. Conrad's eyes flicked back and forth between the window and the instruments. It was absolutely the worst way to have to fly. With his attention split, but he had no choice. The gauge that was supposed to display lateral motion seemed to be broken, forcing him to look outside to make sure he wasn't drifting sideways or, even worse, backwards. 30 feet coming down at 2, Bean said. "Plenty of gas, babe, plenty of gas." 30 seconds, warned Jerry Carr in mission control. Bean answered, "He's got it made." Conrad was now flying entirely by instruments. He had planned to wait until touchdown to shut off the engine, but suddenly he saw the blue glow of the contact light, and instinctively his hand went to the engine stop button, and Intrepid fell the last few feet to the dust with a firm thump. Conrad had logged 100 seconds of stick time, the only real flying he would get on Apollo 12, but they had required every ounce of experience from 20 years of piloting. He had landed on target, he was sure of that. And just now his friend and former student was slapping him on the back, saying, "Good landing, Pete. Outstanding, man." 5:38 a.m., Houston time. 4 days, 19 hours, 16 minutes, mission elapsed time. "You're headed right square out the hatch. Wait, wait, wait. Come forward a little. There you are." With Bean giving him guidance, a fully suited Pete Conrad crawled out of Intrepid's front hatch and onto the porch. Caution dictated that he move slowly in the lunar vacuum, but Conrad was impatient. From the moment of touchdown, he couldn't wait to get outside. He had to get down to the surface and find out once and for all whether the surveyor was really there. Looking out the window, it was impossible to tell where they were. Like Armstrong and Aldrin, he and Bean couldn't gauge distances or sizes, and that made it all but impossible to figure out what craters were in front of them. But when Conrad finally stood on the top rung of the ladder, he could actually see part of the surveyor crater. In fact, he realized, with a mixture of relief and alarm, he had landed Intrepid not 10 yards from its rim. He headed down the ladder while a color TV camera broadcast the scene to Earth. Conrad knew people wouldn't remember the third man to walk on the moon. There was no need to make up something momentous to say. But he did have a quote. In fact, he had a bet to win. The bed had its origins in the heat of a Houston summer afternoon when Conrad and his wife, Jane, were by the pool entertaining Italian journalist Oriana Fallaci. Conrad had known Fallaci since 1964, when she came to Houston to write a book on the astronauts. Fallaci never had any trouble speaking her mind, especially when it came to bureaucracy. And that afternoon, she was convinced that NASA's bureaucrats had told Neil Armstrong what to say when he stepped on the moon. Conrad tried to convince her otherwise, but she was certain of it. Conrad persisted. He couldn't swear that Armstrong had written, "One small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind," but he was sure that whoever had penned it, Armstrong had chosen what he would say. "Look," he told his guest, "I'll prove it to you. I'll make up my first words on the moon right here and now." "Impossible," Fallaci pronounced in her thick accent. "They'll never let you get away with it." "They won't have anything to say about it, Oriana. They won't know about it until I'm on the moon." Conrad had a good idea. Since he was nearly the shortest guy in the astronaut office, why not say... When Fallaci responded, "You'll never do it," Conrad answered, "How about $500? They shook on it. Conrad reached the last rung of the ladder, held on with both hands, and jumped. He fell to the footpad with a gentle bump. "Whoopee! Man, that may have been a small one for Neil, but it's a long one for me." As Neil Armstrong had done, Conrad held on with his right hand and placed his left boot on the moon. He swirled his foot in the dust. "Ooh, is that soft and queasy? I don't sink in too far." Still holding on, he planted both feet on the surface, then let go. His first steps brought him into the blinding glare of the sun. He turned away from it, moving in small, floating steps across the shadowed ground. Leaning forward at an impossible angle to compensate for his backpack, he felt as if he might fall over at any moment. "Well, I can walk pretty well, Al, but I've got to watch where I'm going." Conrad kept walking until he could look past Intrepid's foil-covered bulk to the east, across a vast bowl, twice the size of a football stadium, and he could hardly believe what he saw. On the crater's shadowed far wall sat a tiny, spindly white shape, Surveyor 3. He let out a high-pitched cackle. "Does that look neat? It can't be any further than 600 feet from here. How about that?" In Houston, Capcom Ed Gibson radioed congratulations, but his words were drowned out by the sound of applause. The trajectory people had done it. Conrad was elated. But the trip to the Surveyor would wait until tomorrow. Right now, Conrad had work to do, and after a few minutes, everyone listening in Houston and around the world heard an unaccustomed sound from the lunar surface, the sound of Pete Conrad humming. Dum-de-dum-dum-dum. Nothing in particular, just tuneless, mindless humming. Dum-de-dum-dum-dum. Inside Intrepid, Bean didn't notice the humming at first. He'd heard his commander do the same thing in the simulator and flying a T-38. Even for Pete, though, this was more than usual. Every few minutes, the tune that had no tune crept onto the Earth-Moon airwaves. In the press room at the manned spacecraft center, the reporters covering the flight half-jokingly wondered if Conrad was on an oxygen high. But to more accustomed ears, this was simply the sound of Pete Conrad in his no-sweat mode. None of his worries had been realized. And now Conrad saw with delight that it was even easier to do his work in 1/6 G than he'd expected. If everything kept going this well, the mission, not to mention some lunar rocks and a few pieces of Surveyor 3, was practically in the bag. 6:13 a.m. For half an hour, Alan Bean had watched as his commander danced over the craters 20 feet below. Now he would follow. As Conrad gave directions, Bean inched backward through the hatch and descended the